I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
On this edition of Parallax Views, we continue our reflections on Afghanistan and the 20 years of U.S. military intervention in that country, this time with Dr. Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. He was the founder of that university's Middle East Studies program, and he has a lot to say about Afghanistan as one of the earliest critics of the war in Afghanistan, even in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks in 2001. We'll discuss all that and much more on this edition of Parallax Views, continuing our reflections on Afghanistan. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that I enjoyed having on last time. We were talking about the situation in Israel. This time we'll be talking about Afghanistan. Dr. Stephen Zunis, how are you doing today?
Good to be with you.
So I guess where I wanted to start is you've actually been a critic of the intervention into Afghanistan almost from the start. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I had an op-ed in USA Today just a few days after 9/11, along with a series of other articles in Foreign Policy and Focus and elsewhere, where I recognized the genuine threat from Al Qaeda. I recognized that the U.S. Had the right, including the use of force, to protect us, such as paramilitary operations targeting the terrorist cells that could threaten us. But the whole framework of making it a war, especially in getting involved in a country like Afghanistan that has a long history of people fighting foreign invaders and the like, would be a big mistake. And I warned correctly, unfortunately, as it ended up, that if Congress did pass this war resolution, we could find ourselves bogged down in years of bloody counterinsurgency war against the people who've had a history of resisting outsiders. I mean, this long before the U.S. intervention, Afghanistan was known as the graveyard of empires, where the Greeks, the Romans, the Mongols, the Persians, the British and the Russians, were driven off as it ends up. The United States was as well.
So one thing I find really interesting, I think you made this argument at Foreign Policy and Focus shortly after September 11th, 2001, and the attacks that occurred. But there's also been a wide variety of voices, expert voices, I should say, from various sides of the political spectrum. I knew libertarians and conservatives that were also saying this. And I think you made this argument too, that in a way, bombing Afghanistan, getting involved in a full-scale war in Afghanistan, actually played into bin Laden's hands. Maybe you could explain that for my audiences. Why would that have played into the hands of enemies of the United States?
Well, in fact, it was disproportionate. I mean, for example, the attack that killed bin Laden in Pakistan, that was proportionate. That was targeting the specific bad guys. There's an in and out kind of military operation. But heavy bombing, sending in 130,000, 150,000 troops into a country, et cetera, it doesn't seem to be a very efficient way of fighting an underground network of terrorist cells. I mean, in fact, that interdiction and intelligence, that's really the way that you go after groups like that. And again, occasionally small scale use of force. But the whole idea that somehow bombing a country, a rural area like Afghanistan, which has already been bombed really heavily by the Soviets during the 1980s, basically turned people off. Indeed, that's why really the Taliban ended up winning. Not because most Afghans identify with their reactionary interpretation of Islam and the misogyny and that kind of thing, but the fact that they were seen as the vanguard against these foreign conquerors, and while they were seen as a puppet government in Kabul. And so it's just this kind of a disproportionate, heavy-handed response that the United States has, trying to impose its will on others. That is, what has that really gave power to extremists like Al Qaeda, like the Taliban. And indeed, in many ways, it parallels the mistakes we made during the Cold War, is that we actually created more communists than we killed by supporting these repressive right-wing dictatorships that would oppress the population and drive people into the arms of these communist guerrillas. In a similar way, our policies have driven many people in the Muslim world to support these extremist groups as a reaction to the U.S. military intervention.
In other words, sort of aggressiveness can actually end up getting people to support, really reactionary causes.
Yeah. Ultimately. Exactly. And let's remember that what we've seen in Afghanistan these past couple of weeks was not a military victory by the Taliban. It was a political collapse of the government. The Taliban swept in these cities with almost no resistance. And because, the Afghan government, had over, at least nominally, had over 300,000 troops compared to only 75,000 with the Taliban. The Afghan government had an air force. They had heavy equipment. They'd gotten over $100 billion of U.S. Armaments. They had training by the U.S. Armed Forces, the largest, most powerful armed forces in the world. The Taliban had none of that. And yet they were able to win pretty easily. And I think this is sort of underlies the mistake the United States has made in a number of places. We think that somehow, if we if we drop enough bombs, if we send enough troops, if we send enough military aid to our allies, that's how you win. But that's not how you win. It's about winning the hearts and minds of the people. And it wasn't like, people were rejecting liberal democracy. The U.S.-backed government was not a liberal democracy. It was one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. We allied with warlords. We allied with opium magnates. We allied with these various tribal militia leaders. This is basically, if you're anti-Taliban, you got our support. Even though some of these warlords I just mentioned were in terms of the treatment of women, torture of dissidents. You got on the list. They were just about as bad as the Taliban. Only they happened to hitch their wagon to us instead of them. That was extremely extremely short-sighted. And again, it's not how one can expect to win. And that's why Biden was right. And I feel it's kind of unusual for me to come to Biden's defense on a foreign policy matter, because I've long been a critic of Biden's positions. He is traditionally kind of a hawk. He supported the Iraq war. He supported Israel's recent war in Gaza. He's supported arms to dictatorships. He's supported this bloated military budget. So it's ironic that people are accusing Biden of not being militaristic enough. But I do give Biden credit for the fact that he recognizes the whole thing with the Afghan government was essentially a Ponzi scheme. It was a house of cards. It was going to collapse sooner or later, and he just happened to have the courage to call it out. Because as he pointed out, we could break the withdrawal agreement that Trump negotiated, which again make Americans targets of the Taliban. We could send in more troops. We could keep fighting, and a year from now we'd be in the same situation. 5 years, 20 years. Why should Americans fight and die for a government that Afghans themselves are not willing to fight and die for?
So there's a lot to unpack there. But first, I also wanted to mention what's really fascinating to me, and this was a point you made in that Foreign Policy in Focus article from so many years back was, you know, this occupation that we underwent for, you know, two decades, the victims of it were not really the Taliban. It was the Afghan people. I mean, the Taliban could hide in the hills, in their bunkers, in their mountain outposts. And it seems like everyone forgot that or just sort of ignored that point.
Yeah, tens of thousands of civilians died, you know, most at the hands of the Taliban, but quite a few of them from U.S. bombing and other counterinsurgency operations. I mean, you know, the U.S. presence, you know, did, you know, arguably make things better for women and others in the urban areas. But it was not sustainable. I mean, I know a fair number of Afghans and Afghan Americans, and including some who are part of prominent political families. A number of them were students of mine at the University of San Francisco. You know, there's a large Afghan community in Fremont, which is in the Bay Area. And the message I kept getting from there is it's not that they objected to the United States and other countries playing an active role. What they objected to was the fact that 90% of our effort was military. I mean, in their view, it should have been maybe 10% military and 90% helping to build grassroots institutions, helping to build civil society, helping with sustainable economic development. And, you know, if you look at the administrations, both Republican and Democratic, and 90% of our effort was on the military front. And much of what was on the development side tended to be these, top-down initiatives of dubious merit that were funneled through certain corrupt elites. And that really, I think, underscored, you know, much of the problem there.
If we could stick on that point for a moment, you know, when you talk about development in Afghanistan, and I think more focus should have been put on development, I think people that are not necessarily educated about these issues or that are, I don't know, maybe have a provincialist mindset will say, well, how can we develop Afghanistan? What economic development is possible there? And I've always been very put off by that kind of response. But just to answer those type of people, what would you say is the type of economic development that could have occurred in Afghanistan that we could have helped with?
Well, for example, helping develop farmer cooperatives and enabling them to have sustainable prices for their crops and the like. I think it could have been in terms of micro dams, solar energy, and with low cost electrical generation. I think it could have been in the form of a sustainable development, projects that have tended to actually push wealth downward in a sense. And instead, we essentially push this kind of neoliberal agenda that is its own form of fundamentalism, one could argue. But it was hard to do, given the enormous amount of corruption, that was tolerated. And the one area I would fault Biden, in fact, about his speech was that he was quite correct in talking about the utter failure of the Afghan government and the structural problems and the like. But what he failed to mention was that the United States essentially created that government. We sustained that government. And the whole idea we had that, what we need is a strong central government. We have a strong central government, then we can bring stability. But the thing in Afghanistan, being a mountainous tribal society, is they don't want a strong, stable government. Thank you very much. they like doing things their way. And a government, if they can bring some economic goodies in occasionally and that kind of thing, that would be fine. But they really don't want outsiders. I'm just talking about foreigners, but people in the urban areas. Even this country, we have this huge divide between the urban and rural parts of our society in terms of their and political views and cultural attitudes and things like that. It is far greater in societies like Afghanistan. If you look back to the communist era, the Soviet-backed governments. I mean, a lot of their programs were actually pretty good and progressive in terms of abolishing the bride price, land reform, you know, education, et cetera. But it was imposed a very heavy hand by arrogant, leaders, educated leaders in the cities. And it created this Islamist reaction. And then, of course, the United States actually encouraged the Islamist reaction because it was anti-Soviet. We supported the most reactionary elements within the Mujahideen, which gave rise to the civil war. And then along comes the Taliban, which was a direct outgrowth of the U.S.-Saudi efforts to Islamicize the refugee population, because you figured the more hardline you were in your practice of Islam, the less likely you would be to compromise with the Soviets, have a ceasefire. We didn't care about liberating Afghanistan. We wanted to bleed the Soviets dry by getting them in this endless counterinsurgency war. And so in many ways, the U.S. played a direct role in the rise of this hardcore interpretation of Islam, because, you know, the rural Afghans had always been quite conservative and quite devout in Islam. But the really hardcore Salafist Wahhabi, you know, stuff that the Taliban does, you know, that's a Saudi import that the United States helped facilitate. And, so in many ways, the United States bears responsibility for this monster that we have then spent the last 20 years trying to suppress.
I feel like another issue with regards to how the U.S. responded after 9/11 when it came to Afghanistan, and I don't know if you agree or disagree, I think you're alluding to it a little bit, though, is I feel like, you know, the public at large in this country, I feel like, doesn't necessarily know a lot about the people of Afghanistan. I mean, you have the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, and, you know, I'm not an expert either, but I feel like even our sort of, maybe even the military or people within the military or within, you know, the Bush administrations and the administrations that followed didn't really understand the people and the culture of Afghanistan, because it's not a monolith and there's a lot of different sort of factions and groups of people within that culture.
Yeah, I mean, there's a multi-ethnic society and one where, there's very little awareness and understanding here in the United States which helped lead to these things. I mean, you know, the U.S. has long rejected the advice of experts. There was near universal opposition among scholars familiar with Iraq about the invasion of Iraq. But, not only did the Bush administration ignore us, but so did Biden and a lot of the pro-war Democrats. With Afghanistan, Afghan Americans and a lot of the knowledgeable academic authorities were bypassed and pretty much, you know, put the military leadership in charge. But the underlying thing that we missed was this history of resistance. And it's not just extremists, you know, who are doing this thing. I mean, a lot of people forget that during the Indian, you know, the Pashtuns, you know, about half are on the Afghanistan side of the border, half are on the Pakistan side of the border. Again, one of these artificial, colonial machinations that divided people. But the Pashtuns on the Pakistani side, of course, they were part of colonial India. And they were very active in the independence struggle. Gandhi called them his best nonviolent warriors, you know, and the Pashtuns, again, we think of being as warlike Taliban, et cetera, et cetera. They engage in some of the most courageous and creative and effective forms of nonviolent resistance the world has ever seen, you know, back in the 1920s and 30s. But whether the resistance has been violent or nonviolent, and this kind of attitude that, you know, we can somehow impose, you know, what our vision of the future, you know, might be, and to think that somehow that would not create the kind of resistance that had driven off empires, you know, for centuries. I was in England a few years ago. I was in New York Cathedral. Like a lot of British cathedrals, you know, they have these burial places for various historic figures, and there was this famous British commander who I noticed was killed in the battle in Kandahar back in 1842. And I remember thinking, damn, the learning curve of empires is pretty slow.
I also wanted to get into the more current issues now with what's been called the Saigon moment and whatnot. But before we get there, you also were contacted by Representative Barbara Lee at one point about Afghanistan. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the Bush administration wanted to push a vote in Congress to authorize the use of force in response to 9/11. And Barbara Lee's office contacted a number of people, with familiarity, with both the constitutional issues in question, but also the regional experts. And the advice I gave, and I imagine others gave as well, I mean, this is what she ultimately decided to do, was that while she was not averse to to authorizing use of force to protect us from al-Qaeda, the wording of this particular resolution was broad enough that she recognized it could end up getting us in this long, drawn-out counterinsurgency war. And she ended up being the only member of Congress. So we're talking about out of 100 senators and 435 members of the House of Representatives, she was the only one to vote against the war resolution. And, she was widely attacked and ridiculed and threatened, for her position. But now, people are looking back as quite prescient. I mean, her speech over the floor saying, let's not rush into this. Yes, we're grieving. We're in shock. And this is horrible, but let's not be, come the evil that we are trying to fight here. And she called for caution. So again, she was the lone voice in recognizing the risk of passing the war resolution, which interestingly enough, subsequent presidents, including Obama, have used to justify military operations in Yemen, in Sudan, Yemen, in Somalia, in Syria, in Libya, and other countries. This is the real danger here, that we don't think about the implications of these kinds of resolution. Now, the Iraq War resolution that had a lot more support, the majority of Democrats actually voted against that. But even here, we have a big problem that by going to war with Iraq. It took the attention of the troops, the generals, our intelligence, our satellites, our interpreters, and all this kind of stuff had been focused on Afghanistan, where we had defeated al-Qaeda. We had defeated the Taliban. The Taliban, they were in exile in Pakistan at this point. It looked like we had won. But while putting all this attention in Iraq, it enabled the Taliban to make their comeback, which culminated, of course, in their march into Kabul recently. It underscores this, the fact that, people can be swept up to making these hasty decisions. I mean, because it was depicted as saying, well, if you don't support, as Bush said, you're either with us or with the terrorists. If you didn't support his war resolution, therefore you want al-Qaeda to attack us. And it was that kind of, that put that Democrats in this political dilemma that they felt they had to support the resolution. Now, fast forward it to more recently, and the Republicans are blaming Biden for losing Afghanistan, for surrendering, ignoring the fact that he was just fulfilling the agreement that Trump had made last year. In fact, he delayed it. I mean, we were supposed to have all our troops out by May. He delayed it a few months. And, if he had decided to tear up the agreement, part of the deal was that in terms of promise of withdrawal, the Taliban would stop attacking us. The U.S. troops, would have started to be under attack again. And again, how much longer would this go again to have the inevitable result? I mean, basically this, as I've been telling folks, Juan Cole, University of Michigan, has used this analogy as well, that basically the whole Afghan enterprise was a Ponzi scheme. It was a house of cards and it was going to collapse sooner or later. And each president was trying to put it off for the next one. And Biden finally had the courage to call it out.
Just for my listeners, you've used that term Ponzi scheme, I believe, twice now, that sort of metaphor. What do you mean by that? How is it a Ponzi scheme?
That it was something that was bound to fail, that the Afghan government was not considered a legitimate government. that it survived only on the aid and assistance of outsiders, including the presence of American troops. That it, the level of ineptitude, the level of corruption, the fact that this was that we effectively installed a government, as opposed to a government that comes up from the from the grassroots, so one that has a social base, and that and no matter how much money we threw at it, how many arms we sent, they were not going to be able to survive without that. And that's why when we're talking about sustainability, we're talking about you need to build things from the bottom up, not just create this edifice at the top and expect it to somehow to somehow work. Again, if you go to Kabul, you'll just see all these palatial mansions up on the hills that were made by government officials that they are able to rip off from foreign aid or from opium trade or things like that. I mean, that's not a government people are willing to fight and die for.
I just wanted to add to that. I think if we were to do a deep dive into the Karzai and Ghani governments, we would see, there was a lot of self-enrichment of the people in power going on at the expense of the Afghan people.
Yeah, very much so. And the attitude was that, if you're anti-Taliban, we'd support you. No matter if you were a ruthless warlord, no matter if you were involved in the opium trade, no matter if you were just as misogynist as the Taliban in terms of the treatment of women, regardless of your tendency to kill and threaten any kind of opponents. I mean, and these were some nasty characters that we supported. That if Afghanistan was truly a democracy, these would not be major players at all. And so again, this I really hope we don't get into this narrative we did in Vietnam, was, oh, we naively thought we could bring democracy to this backward country or whatever. Well, the Thieu regime in Saigon was not a democracy; it was a brutal right-wing dictatorship. And similarly, though the government in Afghanistan, they did stage elections. There was at least some degree of political pluralism on some level. It really didn't have any more legitimacy in the sense of having the credibility in the eyes of the population.
So in regards to the exit strategy, do you think that mistakes were made? Was this sort of a Saigon moment?
I do think that the Biden decision to withdraw, I think, was an overall good one. I don't think it was handled very well. I mean, I think that's fairly obvious. I do think there should be some investigations. I think there should be accountability, definitely, because they did not expect that the fall would be as rapid as it was. I mean, I didn't expect it. I think a lot of people didn't expect it. Really, it's pretty stunning, actually. But one would think, given all the ridiculous amount of money we sent in terms of intelligence and that kind of thing, that there are some people in Washington who should have known that this kind of scenario was possible and had made that we would have strategized accordingly. And so, of course, a lot of people are worried about the fate of Afghans who served as translators and people who worked in the embassy and otherwise cooperated with the United States, how they might be seen as collaborators by the Taliban. They could, their lives, may be in danger. And it's kind of ironic, some of the very Republicans who are accusing Biden of abandoning these allies, the very people who tried to block Muslims from seeking political asylum in the United States, with their anti-immigrant and racist and Islamophobic, policies. But there clearly a lot of things were mishandled. The good news is that it does appear that the Taliban government is allowing for flights to continue to evacuate people from the many thousands who fled to the Kabul airport. And and so far, we have not been hearing of widespread executions or anything like that. But it is a very dicey situation, and I think it really was not handled well.
I was going to say, in regards to the Taliban, they're trying to. I think they just had the press conference aired on BBC, for example. They're saying, okay, we're going to respect women's rights. We're going to respect all these things. Do you think they've changed at all? Or are we going to get more of the same? Are they just doing this for press now? And then maybe when things quiet down, things will get much worse.
Well, I think one area that I think that I'm reasonably confident that they have shifted is that they are not going to be willing to allow Al-Qaeda or similar groups to have sanctuary in their territory, because we saw the consequences of doing that. And I think that, and that's really the main thing. I see. I mean, normally that's what our intervention was for, was to go after Al Qaeda. We weren't supposed to nation build and make it a war against the Taliban per se. So I think in that area, that's the one area where I think arguably they may have changed. Overall, it's hard to say. I mean, I think one thing that may have shifted is I don't think there's necessarily been a moral transformation by the Taliban leadership at all. But I do think that, even though the U.S. didn't do much to build civil society, that in the past 20 years, and at least in the urban areas, a lot of Afghans themselves have helped to build civil society, sometimes in support of programs by various non-governmental organizations, by the United Nations and others. So in a sense, I think the ability of the Afghan people to resist certain reactionary structures of the Taliban is greater, just simply through large-scale non-cooperation. And I think the Taliban knows this. And so just as on a pragmatic level, they recognize it's not a good idea to support international terrorist groups, the global reach that could get the wrath of Western nations against you, they may also recognize that whatever they may feel is theologically correct, that they cannot impose quite as draconian strictures on people's day-to-day lives as they did in their previous incarnation. That's my hope anyway. Again, I certainly guarantee.
So since we were talking about Biden's approach to all of this, one thing I've heard from the sort of pro-Trump, pro-Republican contingent is that this is Biden's fault because we had the deal with Trump, and then we extended it. We delayed the withdrawal, and that's why all of this is happening now. How would you respond to that? I'm not sure it's the best.
That doesn't make sense at all. I mean, it would have happened in May instead of August. I mean, I think that argument's pretty silly, really. In fact, it's got kind of interesting that the Republican National Committee had a page up that was praising Trump for the Afghan agreement, and they took it down 2 days ago. They've now shifted to blaming it all on Biden. But in fact, Biden is no more responsible for what happened, for the collapse of the Afghan government, than Gerald Ford was for the collapse of the Saigon government and the communist takeover in Vietnam. Because we look at what happened in Vietnam, you don't have people saying, oh, it's all Gerald Ford's fault because the final collapse happened when he was president. And it's just as silly to say, oh, it's all Joe Biden's fault because the final collapse happened when he was president. As with Vietnam, it was a result of decades of lies, of hubris, of tragic mistakes, and a whole series of other things that were not Biden's fault. And again, I'm someone who's quite willing to criticize Biden where he deserves it. But again, this is hardly his making.
The thing that gets me are also the criticisms I think we see coming out of, I would say, Max Boot type characters that I think were very against the withdrawal, and are using what happened with the exit strategy to say, see, we shouldn't have withdrawn But I keep thinking to myself, are we just supposed to stay there indefinitely? Like, I mean, maybe we could have done this 10 years from now, but would the same thing not have happened? It could.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that is the thing, that each president's kind of kicked the can down the road because they didn't want to be the ones to lose Afghanistan. But the results would be the same. And that's what Biden pointed out, that, you know, what if we did bring troops back here? Let's do another year and we draw then, and then they take over. Do we do it in 5 years? Do we do it in 20 years with the same results? And how much more of our treasury? I mean, the U.S. taxpayer spent $1 trillion on this war. We actually sent, this is more aid to Afghanistan than even counting for inflation than a Marshall Plan of Western Europe. What do we have to show for it? In other words, the result would have been the same, either way. Again, it was on a flimsy foundation. Again, that's why I use the Ponzi scheme analogy. Ponzi schemes, you might be able to figure out a way to extend a little longer, but it's going to collapse eventually. You can't change that.
One thing that did put me off about Biden's address, and I don't know if you felt this way about it, but I almost got a sense at times that speech was saying, well, the Afghan people didn't want to accept a new form of government. And I understand that to a certain extent, but I also don't think we should take this sort of xenophobic approach. And I'm not sure
it was not a rejection of democracy. It was a rejection of kleptocracy. It was a rejection of a foreign government imposed from the outside. And in favor of what appears to be, on one hand, led by a reactionary element, but one that was able to take advantage of the strong sense of nationalism and tribalism and other things that rejected, the imposition of something of this outside. Because again, what do the Afghans see from the United States? What do they see from our democracy? Bombing of the countryside, search and destroy missions, people raiding their homes, this is the kind of thing that it builds its own kind of resentment. And similarly, the Biden's criticism of the Afghan government and this way of handling things, on one hand, is valid, but it kind of ignored the fact we created that government, that we sustained that government, and And so we bear some responsibility, for that government's actions.
Yeah, and I guess what I was going to get at was, I saw this speech that the Republican ne'er-do-well, as I would call him, Dan Crenshaw, was giving about, I don't think Afghans are ready for the freedom they're about to get. And I was just rolling my eyes because I'm really tired of this sort of, I would just say, racist conceptualization of Afghans is this like completely otherized entity. I think they're human beings just like us. They live, they love, they get married, they die. I mean,
as I mentioned earlier, during the nonviolent struggle against the British, the Pashtuns, which are the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, were Satyagrahis of the first order. They were quite good at the nonviolent resistance, and that the it is not that artificially constructed government by outsiders along neoliberal lines that we cobbled together without really input of the Afghans themselves. I mean, rejecting that is not a rejection of democracy.
So before we close out, I just had maybe two more questions. The first was, what do you think the main lessons we should draw from the 20 years in Afghanistan are? And ultimately, do you think we'll learn those lessons?
Obviously, the old adage about not getting a land war in Asia is something that we thought we'd learned after Korea and Vietnam, but we've I made that mistake again. I think this idea of nation building, at least along the lines that the U.S. tried to do, is mistaken. But I think the underlying thing really is that this idea that we can have military solutions to complex political, social, cultural problems that have a history that we did not pay attention to the people who, the Afghans themselves and the people who know that, who know that society, who know that history. And, that military means is a blunt instrument in terms of being able to control a population, that, asymmetrical warfare, can still, wreak havoc on even the most powerful armed force in the world, and that that we need to really redefine security. It's legitimate to go after those that who can do us harm, like Al-Qaeda. But that was completed in the fall of 2001 when we pushed Al-Qaeda out. Al-Qaeda really hasn't made a comeback in Afghanistan, even in areas where the Taliban controls. So why were we still there after 19 years? So I think there are any number of lessons, and I just hope to God it doesn't end up being one of these things where people just try to put the blame on Biden for recognizing that it was a failure and having the courage to finally call it quits.
I mean, to be honest too, I was just going to add to that. I think Biden was able to do something that I think previous presidents had alluded to. I mean, when Obama came into office, we had people like Ben Rhodes saying, there is a problem with this sort of DC foreign policy consensus. Yeah. And Biden was the one that actually put his foot down, and he's standing firm on this. So
yes, and again, some of the fine points of the withdrawal and the chaos that followed needs to be criticized, and certainly there are other aspects of Biden's foreign policies that do deserve criticism as well. But the attacks that he's getting from the right, including some members of his own party, really is. Is unjustified, and I, and again, that's why I'm in an uncharacteristic position of coming to Biden's defense. Because again, I think in this case, he recognized reality and was willing to take the political risk to follow through on that.
I was going to say, I'm glad I'm not the only one that is feeling like, oh, this is strange. I feel like I'm defending Biden. So, so the last thing, and just give me a second to explain here. I'm really sort of perturbed by some of the responses I get to anyone who was pro-withdrawal. I will get told things like, well, you don't care about the women and the children. And I'm really kind of just burnt out on a lot of the moral finger wagging, especially, not to pull a whataboutism, but some of the things our country has done allying with regimes that don't have a good human rights record. I find it hard to take seriously people that want to talk about human rights when they don't look at what's happening in Saudi Arabia, for instance. And I was just wondering, how do you respond to these accusations
Promoting women's rights and just supporting human rights anywhere should be a high priority for the United States. But I think it's the areas where we should focus on areas where we really can make a difference. For example, stop providing arms to misogynist regimes. Like Saudi Arabia. Right now, Biden is siding with Republicans against House Democrats to make sure that military aid to the Sisi dictatorship in Egypt remains unconditional. 86% of the world's autocratic regimes get military aid from the United States, the world's largest provider of arms to dictatorial regimes and occupation armies. And so suddenly to say, oh, we should care about that failure to continue prosecuting the war in Afghanistan is a failure to stand up for human rights, is really misplaced when there's so many areas where we could support human rights more effectively and with less consequences. And so human rights, including women's rights, are critically important. But again, it should not just be brought to the fore as an excuse to continue an unwinnable war, but should also be used in areas where we're not just fighting against people who violate human rights, but we're actually facilitating and supporting those that are violating human rights, as we're doing in many other parts of the Middle East and beyond.
And I just wanted to say, too, just to put a fine point on that, and then I promise to let you go. We went a little over time, and I appreciate that. I think, if we look at the track record in the past 20 years in Afghanistan with women's rights, it wasn't necessarily perfect either, even when the Taliban wasn't in power.
Exactly. Indeed, a lot of these people were, Afghanistan, even under the current government, it was generally ranked among the worst dozen countries in the world in terms of women's rights. It was not, certainly wasn't as bad as it was under the Taliban's first round of governing, but it wasn't great. And I think it's important not to, the concern about the rights of women in Afghanistan under Taliban rule is quite legitimate. But again, I don't see how U.S. could have made much of a difference given the circumstances that are on the ground. And this I think is an important piece that I think that there's a tendency on both the right and segments of the liberal and left side of the political spectrum as well, to believe that the United States somehow has more power than it does to for good or for evil. And that there are certain things that we really do have to wash our hands of, as painful and as difficult as it may seem, and to acknowledge that, practically speaking, there really isn't much we can do about certain things. And that's really hard. I mean, that's really hard. I feel that way about a lot of things. I really don't think that the legitimate concern about the rights of women under Taliban rule, should be used as an excuse to justify a never ending an unwinnable war, which ends up being worse for women in the overall sense. I mean, that's the thing. Remember the Soviet war, the heavy bombing of the Afghan countryside, which is even worse than what the U.S. did. That was in the name of promoting the rights of women. The U.S. intervention was in the name of promoting the rights of women. But women are often the first casualties when it comes to war. So, mandatory burqas is maybe one manifestation of anti women policies, but so is dropping bombs on villages.
I also just wanted to add to that. Do you think what has just occurred with Afghanistan, maybe this will be a wake up call with regards to what I would say is our own mythology about American exceptionalism, which, as you point out, I think that it affects both the right and the left. I think a lot of people on the left think that, the U.S. is almost this all-powerful entity that can do bad. And I think we also see this on the right. Oh, it's an all-powerful entity that can do good. And I think both are manifestations of this exceptionalist mythology.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that kind of arrogance, the kind of hubris we really need to be thoughtful about. And I think what really do need to do is to do a lot more listening, especially people from these countries and within our own country. We need to listen more to women, to people of color, to people who have not traditionally been in positions of power, and to stop acting like a bunch of white male, especially politicians in Washington that have access to powerful weapons and weapon systems are somehow going to be, the ones who are going to go out and set things right in the world, because those are the very people who are responsible for much of the suffering we have in the world today.
Well, Dr. Stephen Zunis, I want to thank you once again for coming on Parallax Views. I cherish the time I get to speak with you because I feel like you are really an expert and are able to really draw out the lessons to be learned from things like this 20-year war in Afghanistan.
My pleasure. I really thank you.
As always, if you enjoy the shows I produce here at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers. Any amount will help this show. And at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout out. So with that in mind, shout outs to Ed, Spartacus, Gunner, Jamie, James, Orc, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Martin, Chase, Gratz, Brian, Mickey, Emilia, and the War Nerd. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then please consider supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. I should be posting new content for $5 tier subscribers and hopefully restarting or relaunching the Discord server very, very soon. I'm trying to get as many interviews about Afghanistan done as possible. I believe this is a rather pivotal moment, so I have a few more episodes in the Afghanistan series to go, and I hope you are finding them insightful. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.